talking about on fly again. My wing got bruised, healing my wounds. I done got fly again. Now all you want is a thing of the past. I can supply 10 metric ton lows coming in from the island.
It's 2 o'clock in Montreal, and you're listening to Montreal's Arabic Diaspora on the CKT Radio 90.3 FM, and I'm Sarah Hassanin. Our weekly show airs every Friday at 2 p.m. The show is split up into two parts. The first part is in English and covers the latest local and global news with a special focus on one story. Then we move on to the second part, which we stream in Arabic. In this part, we usually talk about special news or cultural events and arts. Sometimes we feature someone from our community who has a story to share. And as of today, I'm happy to announce that we will start streaming the first episode of our podcast, Nostalgia. Nostalgia tackles different immigration settlement issues as experienced by the Arabic Middle Eastern diaspora living in Montreal. For this week's show, here's our stories. Four family members were attacked and killed in London, Ontario last week. Ontario police stated that the attack most likely targeted the family for being Muslim. We'll talk more about this incident. A vigil was held for the family at Park Extension in Montreal on Friday. Many Montrealers attended the vigil, as well as politicians. Joe Bongiorno is a freelance journalist and fiction writer based in Montreal. He studied journalism at Concordia University. Bongiorno decided to cover the vigil story for a local magazine. I called Bongiorno to see if he could join us on our show to talk about the event, how he covered it as it's a sensitive issue, his take on media coverage issues as a journalist. And he'll also tell us about the difference between writing for the news as it compares to writing stories for literature. Joey welcomed the idea, and he'll be with us today, so stay tuned. Next, we'll move on to brief you on the Algerian student Islam Gedrez's case. Islam Gedrez is an Algerian student who went missing weeks ago and whose dead body was found on May 30th in a forest in Rodin. In the last part of the show, you'll be listening to the first episode of Nostalgia in Arabic. The podcast tackles the reflections and experiences of many immigrants and newcomers to Canada. You're listening to Montreal's Arabic Diaspora on the Radio CKT 90.3 FM. And for CKT, I'm Sarah Hassanin. It's time now for the news headlines. And here's the news for Montreal's Arabic Diaspora show on Radio CKT 90.3 FM. Quebec goes 3 days in a row without a reported death due to COVID-19. Off-island English schools get $300 million as a new fund. East Montreal Health Authority got hit by a cyber attack. 5 patients' data has been compromised. Ville-Aimar High School finds a new way to honor residential schools' victims. Habs Mark Bergevin among 3 finalists for NHL's GM of the Year award. Universities and colleges wrestle with mandating COVID-19 vaccines to return to campus. Quebec's health minister deems Moderna vaccine a better choice for a second dose, though AstraZeneca is still an option. A 10-year-old boy drowned during a school field trip in Quebec City.
It would be the last trip of my family. It never comes to my mind. What we have seen in London, Ontario, is not only Islamophobia. It's not only hate. It is terrorism. It is terrorism by all means. And we have to name it. I have repeated it everywhere. Brothers, sisters, let me tell you, I had many interviews lately, including international, BBC, Washington Post, Al Jazeera, every news think that we are in a war zone. is not good. We made sure that this is not the image. After the massacre of 2017, I received a call from the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. He was paying all his respect, and he was showing his solidarity. Very appreciated. I said, Mr. Prime Minister, I have one request. Humbly, please consider this a terrorist act. Again, this time, what is the difference? Why you are so much insisting, Samer, on calling it what it is? Because it has to be dealt with. I'm so worried that our tears will dry and we will forget about those people. And we will come again and again until we address the matter very seriously. Am I optimistic? I believe so, my nature. We have dealt, and we have to be very open today. We have dealt with the federal government, and it was very open. I heard a lot of people ready to listen at every level. But now we need actions. And again, we're not here to say it is the problem of the issue of the federal government, not at all. It's not us. It is every one of us. Few days ago, or a couple of days ago after the massacre, just a few days ago, I think the day before yesterday, we had a meeting. The quantity of hate on social media against those who were killed and murdered is unbelievable. We took a strategic decision not to share it, not to post it. So hate is entrenched in us, and we need to remove it. I really thank you so much for being here. I want to say that there is a big presence of the federal government today, which I so much appreciate. I would like to raise also the MPs that are here. Monsieur Benoit Charette from the provincial government, CAC. I really appreciate your presence. All the MPs, Madame Valérie Plante, all the mayors, ex-mayors, the fact that we are all here, honest to God, is my optimism. That's why I'm so optimistic. We are Canadians, we are Quebecers, we are humans. Inshallah, one message for those terrorists. We are not going to give up at all, at all, at all. Thank you so much for being here.
The killing of four members of a Muslim family in London, Ontario, has been the talk of Canadian media for weeks. On Sunday night, Afzal's family had gone out for a walk in their neighborhood in London when a truck suddenly moved onto the sidewalk and knocked them down. Salman Afzal, his wife Madiha Salman, their daughter Yumna Afzal, and Salman's mother Talat Afzal were killed. The youngest member of the family, 9-year-old Faiz, survived and remains in hospital and is now aware his family is dead.
A surviving 9-year-old child eventually leaves the hospital and makes enough physical recovery, he will need severe mental health support. This will be a long, difficult, and painful road for him because he will have to live with the reality that his country's Islamophobia cost him his family's life. Faiz will not be able to hug his mother tonight or pass a ball around with his father tomorrow. Faiz will not be able to listen to his grandmother talk about her childhood tales or watch with pride as his sister paints another mural or graduates. Faiz won't be able to celebrate his many milestones with his family throughout his life. This is the reality that should be highlighted right now.
The perpetrator is a 20-year-old London Nathaniel Veltman who murdered the family with his vehicle. Police have released few details about Veltman, who was charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of attempted murder. Police further say that speaking too much about the case could jeopardize it. However, police have also said they believe this family was targeted because of their Muslim faith. While there is no connection or acquaintance between the attacker and the victims, and despite finding no trace of Veltman in any online hate groups or activities, The Independent has referred to him as, and I quote here, a Christian terrorist. Information on social media confirms that Veltman is an extremely fanatic Christian. Records also show that he is mentally unstable and has been estranged from his family. Veltman's parents are petrified by what's happened and have expressed their deepest and saddest condolences to the victims' families. Social media followers have expressed their frustration with the way Veltman's photos have been selected and posted because they feel that this would manipulate people into thinking he's a victim too.
I'm actually tired of the media narrative that strives to humanize time and time again every white terrorist and hate crime perpetuator. The media's job is to show, not tell. This terrorist mowed and murdered an entire family with his truck. When he was arrested, he was wearing an armored vest, singing and chanting with no signs of remorse. So I frankly could not care less what marathon he ran or how reliable of a friend he was. He massacred an entire family in cold blood and left a 9-year-old child orphaned and fighting for his life in the hospital. This is who he is. It's not my job right now to feel empathy for a terrorist and his poor mental health. This should not be at the very top of my list right now.
Many safety concerns are expressed by some members of London's Muslim community, which numbers 30,000. A vigil was held for the family in London, and thousands went to the burial and funeral of the family as the Canadian flag wrapped their caskets. In Montreal, a second vigil was held at Park Extension on Friday. A big number of Montrealers was there, including Muslims, non-Muslims, and prominent Quebec politicians who clearly addressed the issue as one of terrorism and Islamophobia. The crowds of protesters did not seem to be happy with some politicians and started to boo them once they were on the podium.
Thank you so much. The freedom of expression is respected. We are in the commemoration of those. Okay. Please.
Many Muslim Montrealers at the vigil also brought up Law 21, the Quebec City shooting, and systemic racism while objecting to what political figures had to say and literally called on the government to denounce Law 21 if Quebec is really serious about combating Islamophobia. Law 21 was legislated in 2019 by the CAQ government. According to the law, public servants such as judges, police members, and teachers are not allowed to wear any religious symbols such as the kippah or the hijab while on the job. In an op-ed, Mona Mazir writes for the Ottawa Citizen about the roots of Islamophobia, and she contends that the roots are much deeper than most Canadians can understand. The interesting point that caught my attention is how she seriously views the daily aggressions witnessed by hijabi women in public spaces in broad daylight without having any serious law enforcement mechanisms that can treat them as Islamophobic acts, but rather allow the acts to be normalized. More about this and about how far women should be visibly Muslim or not, and what is the cost we have to pay for being visible Muslim in this climate today we're dealing with in the West in general. This is something I would like to further tackle next week. But now we're going to move on to Joe Bongiorno, a journalist and a freelance author based in Montreal, who covered the vigil in Montreal and was there at Park Extension. We're going to be talking about Canadian media coverage issues, how he found covering such a sensitive issue easy or difficult. And he's also going to be talking about how writing short stories for literature may compare to writing for journalism. So stay tuned. You're listening to Montreal's Arabic Diaspora on CKT Radio 90.3 FM.
Okay, sorry. A vigil was held in Montreal on Friday, June 11th. And Joe Bongiorno is a freelance journalist and author based in Montreal. Bongiorno studied journalism at Concordia University, and he happened to be one of the journalists who covered that vigil on Friday. And today we have Joe Bongiorno with us on the show. Joe, welcome to our show on CKT Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So why did you choose to cover the story, Joey?
Well, I think it was it's an important story, and I work a lot in Park Extension. and it took place in Park Extension. And definitely, I mean, it was a well-attended event. A lot of politicians showed up, and there's definitely been, you know, in context with a lot of, I guess, it seems like there's a lot of rising tension, you know, in context with some of the things that were talked about at the event. Well, I think that, I mean, there was a whole family was killed on it's a random act of violence, or I guess not so random, I should say, because it's said to be a premeditated and targeted attack. So it's a vicious killing, and discussion of what constitutes terrorism and what's not is an important one. Terrorism is sort of a vague term at times, but possibly applied differently and thought of differently depending on who's accused of doing what. So that caught my interest, and also the fact, you know, that aside from the fact that it's a tragedy, and there's a lot of momentum, I think, going toward calling the act for what it is, in the opinion of many, including people at the event, including my own personal opinion, that it's if it's a target of the act of hatred, backed by an ideology, then that seems to be terrorism.
Could you describe the scene for us? What did you see when you got there?
So it was definitely an emotional event. There's a lot of grief, you know, people laying flowers by the stage where, you know, there was a podium in front of what used to be a train station in Park X, across the street from the Islamic Center. And so emotions were running high. A lot of people with signs. I saw some, you know, there was definitely a display of solidarity. There were some people who, you know, for example, had signs saying, a lot of signs were targeting Bill 21. A lot of people had signs also addressing the 2017 killing at the Quebec City
Quebec
mosque.
City.
And, but there was also a lot of, for example, I saw a group of people with kippahs, and I was speaking to them, and they clearly wanted to show their solidarity. And just a lot of people wanting to voice their sympathies, to lend their voice, you know, out of concern for what went on. And that's beside, you know, sort of the, maybe you could say that sort of almost the pageantry of all the politicians. There were a lot of different federal and Quebec based local politicians. But yeah, I would say that it was a feeling of grief, mourning, and definitely anger, lots of anger, and possibly cathartic during some of the speeches when people were, you know, voicing their anger, maybe in a way that they don't often get to have their voices heard.
I can see that there was a bunch of politicians at that event in Central Park. Benoit Charette, Denis Coderre, Gabriel Dubois, Valérie Plante, and there are also activists. Samir Merzoub, the director of the Canadian Muslim Forum, was also there. When you picked who to interview or speak with, what factors were guiding your choices?
Well, I almost wish that when you attend an event like this, everyone would have name tags so that you could see who's who.
Yeah.
So some people you interview because, you know, I chose to interview because I knew who they were, and they're, you know, covering Park X. You know, for example, I saw the city councilor of, you know, representing Park Extension, so I wanted to speak to her. But then obviously seeing the former mayor who is running for political office now, Denis Coderre, you know, that's an interesting, he's an interesting person to want to speak to. Not saying that what he said was necessarily the most captivating, but what I felt was, you know, more important, or at least as important as what, you know, the the people in suits have to say is to interview the people who just are there, and they, you know, they're there because they want to be. So I was like, you know, people who are holding signs, just everyday citizens or activists or just concerned people. You know, there were some people holding like a banner that said, it was basically, I don't remember what it said exactly, but it was essentially a Jewish group of some kind who wanted to show that they were there in support. So for me, that's more interesting than maybe what a certain politician would say. But I think that you have to do both, just because the people who hold power are powerful, and the things they say and the power they wield makes them consequential. But I think it's also just as important, maybe more, to cover the everyday people who actually experience maybe the prejudice and are just, you know, they're there as themselves. They're not there because they're in public office or trying to get into public office.
Right. And during the protests, there were also angry protesters, like you said, and there was so much booing, especially when some particular politicians stepped on the podium to give a speech. So why do you think that was the case? Why all this anger?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's sort of a palpable tension, and I don't think the pandemic has helped that much. Not that that was related to the pandemic. But there's a lot of, I guess I don't have to think about it, because I'll just take people at their word. And what people were kept bringing up again and again, were bringing up Bill 21 and the 2017 mosque shooting, but especially Bill 21. And when Benoît Charette, the minister in the fight against racism, who's part of the Coalition Avenir Québec, the CAQ government, stepped onto the stage to take the mic, he was immediately booed because people were screaming hypocrite. There was one person who was particularly vocal, saying he denies systemic racism. So, I mean, the people spoke for themselves. And what's interesting is that in the reporting I've read about this, because I read other people's reporting, a lot of people didn't report what the people were actually saying. I noticed that a lot of articles just said there was booing, but it's not just booing. There's specific grievances that are brought up and specific concerns. You know, and speaking to different people, it's true that Bill 21 is a Quebec-based bill, and the killing happened in London, Ontario. But I think what people are concerned about is the atmosphere and the climate of, I think what they would say is, you know, intolerance or whatever has led to incidents like what happened to the family in London, but just the climate of systemic racism being denied in Quebec, I think is particularly angering to many. And people were screaming hypocrite. And so the fact, I think, that someone was there to make a speech, he's the only person that I could tell was from the CAQ, definitely the only CAQ person who spoke. I think that felt, sort of hypocritical to some, and that's what at least some people were screaming. And the other thing, let me see here, there's something else. That's something else to add.
May I ask you here, why did the protesters bring up Bill 21 in particular? Like, from your perspective as a journalist, how do you see they actually drew a link between Bill 21 and what happened in London, Ontario?
Well, I guess it comes down to, and I'm not speaking for myself here, speaking to what I interpreted from people, what they were saying, but part of a larger atmosphere of intolerance, of it's a law that's perceived to be targeting the Muslim community more than other groups of people, in a time where there's, you know, sort of more, Quebec is taking a bit of a swing to the more conservative brand of politics, of identity-based politics, which is not new in Quebec, but no, I think it's being felt particularly right now. You know, and that's part of a global trend as well. And it was not appreciated. And I think that it seems to me like the Muslim community feels targeted by these bills, by these laws, by this climate. And this was an occasion to let maybe their voices heard, to ask people to denounce it. And for example, when the Liberal Party, there was Minister Pablo Rodriguez and Madeleine Jolie and some other politicians, when they left the stage, a woman screamed, why doesn't the Liberal Party denounce Bill 21? And she said, I can't believe anything you said is authentic if you don't denounce it. And, you know, that's sort of been, they've punted on that one, or they've just not gotten into it. And I think that people feel that they're not being protected enough, or that it's politically expedient to ignore it, to ignore the politics that's happening here in Quebec. So regardless of whether or not the actual killing took place in Quebec or not, I think it's just part of a larger feeling of being targeted or not being valued, or that their problems, their issues, their concerns are not important enough for politicians to address.
What do you think actually perpetuates racism in the first place? As a journalist who studied journalism at Concordia, do you think Canadian media has a role to play?
Of course, yeah. And it's a difficult thing to do. Mistakes will be made. And for me, what it comes down to is, one thing is to have the intention to do something well and being open to feedback, to be doing things correctly. And not everyone will agree on the best way to do things. But there are challenges. So for example, myself being a reporter, being there, not having, I have plenty of experience as a writer, but I'm fresh in the world of journalism, which is a very different experience, because you're covering, the stories of people. So for example, just speaking to someone who was there, who was wearing a kippah, that's why I saw that person. I'm like, well, okay, that would be interesting to get, because assuming he's there to talk about, solidarity, which he was. But then when I was writing my article, I wondered whether or not I should mention the fact that he was wearing a kippah, because it's something that communicates to the reader that, he's not Muslim, but he's there. And this isn't a scenario where it reflects well on the person. At the end, I chose not to mention that detail. I have to be honest that I don't know, maybe this isn't such a consequential example, but it's just to show that even in the details, there are questions that you ask yourself about how to best reflect what happened without tokenizing people or, necessarily you want to give people the space to express themselves, but you don't want to make them into like a caricature. And you just want to be fair, but also, keeping in mind that when it's in the media, when it's in print, when it's in audio or whatever medium you're working in, there could be consequences for the people who you're speaking to. And, you also want to make sure that what they're saying is not, sort of representative of at least a larger group of people, if you're going to present them as such. So there are, I don't know, it's an issue that's very complicated. As a journalist, I try to do my best. I speak to others to get their opinions on such matters. But for sure, as a white straight guy, I'm on the outside of some of these issues, but I do the best I can in doing it as fairly as I can.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the difficulty of covering such stories as, like you said, as a white male journalist? How difficult is it to cover stories pertinent to ethnic minorities issues in Canada?
I don't know if I could put it on a scale because it, it depends on what type of story you're doing. But it it is challenging. It's this one was challenging too because of the subject matter, because you know we're talking about people being targeted because of you know because of who they are essentially, right? It's not, you know, it's really because of the fact that they stand out as not being, you know, they're the because they're being otherized that they were targeted. So I can't put a number on it, but I would say it's very important to do well, and definitely warrants a lot of attention to do well. What was the other part of the question?
I wanted to know how you felt. Was it hard? Like, were you telling yourself, "Oh, that's a tough one." Like.
Yeah,
trauma, the fact that they're a minority that might share cultural values that you're not really acquainted with, you know, how difficult is that?
Yeah, no, it's very difficult. I mean, it's very difficult for the, you know, the things I just mentioned, but also because when you're presenting people's stories, it's so, you know, you're presenting what you're saying is reality, right?
Yeah.
So that's like the official account is the you know, not everyone has a microphone or has access to the medium to get to express, to show you how they think the world looks. So it's definitely a lot of attention to words that are being used. For example, if you're talking about, you know, Indigenous communities, there's a lot of attention to, at least now, to the types of words you use, you know, not saying that, you know, from things I guess the big and small, from capitalizing certain letters to avoiding some kinds of problematic constructions that sort of replicate power hierarchies that are historically inaccurate and things like that. And it's also difficult because, you know, I think I wonder how many journalists would feel, especially, you know, people like us who sort of just starting out, feel like they've actually gotten an education on this, you know, like we're told to be wary about certain things, to be careful. And that's good, you know, of course, to be careful, but it's not like there's a handbook. So I'm just trying to do the best I can to use my sense of my moral compass, but also to pay attention. And I think if you're open and you pay attention, you will still make mistakes. Maybe you still get chewed out, but you know, I'm doing the best I can, and I'll try not to. Definitely trying not to tokenize or belittle or. Do any harm. The idea, you know, like they say in J school, is to minimize harm, and I think that's a learning process, like anything else. But yeah, definitely, we wield a lot of power in journalism, even though we don't have the paychecks to prove it, and it's a very precarious job. We do have a lot of power, and we could possibly inflict a lot of harm if we're not careful, and that's a learning process.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're an author too, right? So you're a journalist, but you're also an author, right? And you've published a selection of essays.
Well, not a selection of essays. I've published a variety of short stories, some essays, some creative nonfiction pieces as well. But never, journalism is something that's you know, new in the past year. I've sort of gotten into.
Well, we must agree that a common factor, something that journalism and creative writing share, is the storytelling, right? So both involve storytelling. Could you tell us like, what differences have you noticed between the storytelling, the way we tell stories in journalism versus the way we tell them in the world of literature?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always a fun thing to, interesting thing to ponder. Definitely, I mean, the clearest thing is that in fiction, you begin and end with your own imagination. The stories don't come, I mean, they could be based on life experience, but at the end of the day, you're not chained to what really happened from getting the account straight. Whereas journalism, you are, you know, you're not supposed to be making stuff up. Basically, fiction is lying. And journalism...
But they're beautiful lies, aren't they?
Exactly. Beautiful lies, meaningful lies. And lies that could maybe tell a much greater truth than, you know, a 500 word article about, you know, this happened there. I don't think you're going to get much truth out of that in the same way. You know, it's a very different kind of thing. I would say journalism is not an art. There's an art to it in doing it well. And there's certainly something to be said about craft. I think no matter what medium you work in, the way you put things together, the way, you know, all the different components fit together and how smoothly it runs. You know, there's always a certain poetry in a job well done. But certainly it's not that sort of creative expression that fiction is or poetry is just by definition, because it's something made up. Yeah. They're both difficult in different ways as well. Like I find that writing a story, a piece of fiction, is liberating because it's made up, but also difficult because you could go any which way, and you're not following a specific compass. You know, you're not grounded in certain facts to guide you. You know, whereas this story, the pressure, for example, of covering the vigil, for me, is just deciding where to go from what's already there, prioritizing what to include, what to leave out, because you definitely can't include everything. Also understanding what type of, you know, article you're writing, because not every article could, you know, be an in-depth examination, a thoughtful examination of a topic, just because of, you know, how long it is and what the scope is. And also in, I think in your journalism, you have, there could be, like as I said before, consequences for real people in a way that is possible in fiction, but perhaps is more impactful or potentially more dangerous in journalism gone wrong.
And which one did you enjoy more in the process? Did you enjoy writing stories and literature or covering stories for magazines and newspapers?
They're very different. I mean, the creative stuff, the writing fiction and creative writing is more, journalism does not scratch the itch that you have for wanting to write creatively. It just doesn't, because it's not creative in the same way. When I write an article, when I wrote my first articles, I felt very accomplished and I had done something, you know, in a way that I felt similar to writing a piece of fiction. But then as it went on, sort of, you know, because you're churning out stories in journalism in a way that you don't in fiction writing, and a piece of fiction requires, you know, an incredible amount of reflection, of time, of going back and forth, of editing. You could completely change the story 500 times if you want to before it gets published, if it ever gets published. You share with an audience to be enjoyed. When you're writing a piece of journalism, it's not necessarily to be enjoyed. It's not, you know, the aesthetic is different. It's not, it's more of a functional thing where you're informing people.
Yeah.
I would relate it more to my experience as a teacher more than to my experience as a fiction writer. Having said that, they are in the end forms of storytelling, and you go from a beginning to some kind of end try to take the reader, the listener, the viewer along the way in a way that captures their attention. So that very much holds. And I think that's a very real parallel, that in either way you want to inform or communicate some kind of message while entertaining them enough not to throw the book or stop on the floor or stop reading the article or sign.
Well, Joey, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. Thank you for joining us. That was Joe Bongiorno, a freelance journalist and author based in Montreal. Thank you very much.
مش باين ليه قلبك تايه من مدة كبيرة خايف تتكلم ليه في عيونك حيرة وحكاوي كتيرة متغير يا ما عن زمان قافل على قلبك البيبان حبيت وفرقت كم مكان عايش جواك إحساسك كل يوم يقل وتخطي وخطوتك تزل من كتر ما أحبط وبتمل فين تلقى دواك بتودع حلم كل يوم تستفرد بيك الهموم وكلكم والغربة كوم والجرح كبير ما بتديش حاجة اهتمام أهلا أهلا سلام سلام بقى طبعك قلة الكلام ومفيش تفسير داري داري يا قلبي مهما تداري قصاد الناس حزننا ما تشوف وهو عادي عقادي محدش في الدنيا معاك في الصورة غاب وطنك والأهل والصحاب كم واحد ودع وساب من غير أسباب شايف في عينيك نظرة حنين بتحن لمين ولا مين طول عمرها ماشية السنين والناس ركاب مع دقة عقرب الساعات بتموت جوانا ذكريات عشمنا قلوبنا باللي فات ونسينا نعيش كان مكتوب نمشي الطريق ونفارق كل ما ده شيء اتسرق العمر بالبطيء ورسي على ما فيش وداري داري يا قلبي مهما داري قصاد الناس حزننا ما تشوف وهو عادي عادي محدش في الدنيا دي بيتعلق بشيء إلا وفراقه يشوف
مساء الخير عليكم، انتوا بتسمعوا برنامج عرب مونتريال على راديو سي كي تي على 90.3 اف ام. برنامجنا بيذاع كل يوم جمعه الساعه 2 الظهر. البرنامج بينقسم الى جزئين، الجزء الاول بيذاع باللغه الانجليزيه وبيغطي اهم الاخبار والقصص اللي تهم الجاليه العربيه اللي عايشه في مونتريال بل وفي كندا كلها. والجزء الثاني من البرنامج بنذيعه بالعربي وبنتكلم فيه عن برضو القضايا الثقافية، ممكن برضو نتكلم عن الفنون اللي هي متأصلة في التراث العربي، وأحيانا بنستضيف شخصيات بيبقى عندها قصة جميلة تحب ان هي تحكيها وتشاركها معنا كلنا. النهاردة انا هذيع اول حلقة من حلقات برنامج نوستالجيا. نوستالجيا زي ما كلنا عارفين معناه الحنين، ونوستالجيا هو الهدف منه انه يتحول ان شاء الله قريبا الى مشروع بودكاست. في البودكاست ده انا بحب ان انا اتناول كل القضايا اللي بتهم المهاجرين، من التأقلم مع الصدمة الحضارية الكالتشر شوك، للحنين للأصحاب وللوطن وللذكريات، للتأقلم مع العادات والتقاليد الجديدة، للمشاكل اللي ممكن أو التعقيدات اللي ممكن المهاجرين يواجهوها في البحث عن عمل، إزاي إن هم يقدروا يحسوا بالاستقرار في المكان الجديد، إزاي يعملوا أصحاب، وكل هذه القضايا. النهاردة الحقيقة احنا هنركز على موضوع حلقتنا النهاردة، هو هنا وهناك او تايه ما بين هنا وهناك. حالة بتنتاب المهاجر من اي بلد، ولما بيروح يعيش في اي بلد مهجر مش شرط كندا، انه بيفضل عنده حالة نفسية زي ما قلنا حالة بتنتابه، هي حالة نفسية من التشتيت. فبتلاقي المهاجر نص دماغه في بلده اللي سابها، والنص التاني في البلد الجديدة اللي هو لسه جاي عليها وبيحاول يستقر فيها. فممكن نقول مثلا ايه الأنماط السلوكية اللي بتثبت انه المهاجر ده بيبقى دماغه نصها في اخبار بلده او متعلق ببلده. بنلاقي سلوكيات معينة، منها مثلا انه يحن، انه يسمع انواع معينة من الموسيقى، انه ياكل اكلات معينة تكون من بلده. علشان كده لما بنيجي للبلاد الجديدة بلاد المهجر، يمكن فكرة تجارية ناجحة جدا هي انك تفتح سوبر ماركت وتبيع فيه الاكلات اللي هي اللذيذة، اللي هي الأثنك، اللي هي بتبقى تبع البلاد بتاعت الناس الجديدة اللي جاية. فبيبقى فيه طبعا مثلا محلات للأكلات الشرقية، في محلات بتكون للأكلات الصينية أو الأسيوية. فكل ده طبعا بيبقى دليل قوي إنه المواطن الجديد اللي جاي هنا لسه مش بيكون متعود على أنواع الأكل الجديدة ولا على نمط الحياة الجديد. التأقلم مثلا مع الجو، ممكن جدا واحد يبقى مفتقد قوي الجو عنده في بلده، مثلا كان عامل ازاي بالمقارنة للبلد اللي هو جالها. لما بنيجي كندا بنقول الدنيا برد قوي، احنا في بلدنا كان في شمس والدنيا كانت دفى طول الوقت، فبيحصل برضو حالة حنين للجو في بلدنا. برضو في تغييرات بتحصل بالنسبة لتقضية الوقت، يعني حتى نظام الوقت وازاي نقضيه بيكون مختلف طبعا ما بين بلادنا وما بين مثلا كندا. فده برضو بياخد وقت من المواطن ان هو او المهاجر الجديد ان هو يتأقلم معه. فاحنا قلنا دلوقتي شوية علامات بتبين ان انت لسه متعلق بوطنك الام. طبعا الاهم بكتير قوي متابعة الميديا، يعني بنلاقي انه حتى رغم ان احنا مسافرين وموجودين هنا في الغربة، الا ان احنا بنتابع السوشيال ميديا، بنتابع الاخبار، بنتابع كل حاجة بتحصل في بلادنا وبنبقى متابعينها بشغف شديد جدا، وكما لو كنا لسه عايشين هناك. طيب ده بالنسبة لحالة انك انت تكون مرتبط بالوطن الام وطبعا برضو كتير جدا نبقى بنفتكر الذكريات وساعات نعيش في الماضي حتى. يعني في ناس كتير ممكن تفضل في حالة انا عايش في الماضي، ايه ده انا كنت بشتغل مثلا دكتور في بلدي، ده انا كنت مدرس في بلدي، انا وظيفتي ما كنتش مقدرها، انا لما جيت هنا مثلا كندا اتصدمت بالواقع. فبيفتكر مثلا ايه الحاجة اللي كانت او الوضع اللي كان متاح في بلده اللي سابها، فده برضو بيبقى بيعتبر نوع من انواع ان انا عايشة لسه هناك بكياني بحالتي النفسية بذهني، انا عايشة هناك مش عايشة هنا. الجزء التاني بقى بيبقى عايش هنا اللي هو طبعا بيضطر يواكب الحياة الجديدة، الجو، نلبس ايه، نتابع برضو الأرصاد الجوية، المدارس، أولادنا هيروحوا المدرسة، طيب ازاي نراسل مديرة المدرسة أو نتواصل مع المدرسين، وسائل المواصلات، بنحاول نستكشف فرص الدراسة والشغل، ازاي نحسن حياتنا، بنبقى عايزين نعرف حاجات كتير عن السكن، نعيش في أنهي مدينة، ازاي نعمل اصحاب، ازاي ندور على شغل. فكل دي برضو بتبقى عوامل جديدة او معلومات جديدة احنا محتاجين برضو نركز معها قوي ونبتدي نستخدمها عشان نقدر نتأقلم مع الحياة الجديدة. لكن للأسف الشديد حالة اللي هو لا هنا ولا هناك دي، وفي نفس الوقت كمان انا نسيت اقول انه في ناس كمان من النوع اللي هي تحب تسافر كتير لبلادها في نص السنة، يعني في ناس تفضل رايحة جاية تروح مثلا كام شهر وترجع تاني، ده برضو بيعمل طبعا نوع من التشتت لانك حاسس انك لا انت هنا ولا هناك. فطيب ايه اضرار ده؟ الضرر اللي بيحصل من حالة ان انا مشتت ما بين العالمين، ما بين هنا وهناك، ما بين اللي كان موجود ساعتها واللي موجود دلوقتي في اللحظة الحالية، هو إن الإنسان زي ما بنقول مشتت، يعني مش هنقدر نحقق حاجة. التشتيت دايما بيعمل نوع من التعثر وما بيكونش فيه تحقيق كويس للذات، والأهداف اللي أنت كنت جاي علشانها ممكن جدا حالة التشتيت دي مش تخليك خالص إنك تقدر تركز على أهدافك وتقدر تحققها. فاصل ونرجع، خليكم معانا.
يتبعين وحبا
ورجعنا لكم مرة تانية. كنا بنتكلم عن حالة التشتيت ما بين هنا وهناك، وإنه الوطن بيكون دايما على البال والخاطر، بنحن للأهالي والأصحاب والذكريات. هي طبعا الحنين في حد ذاته هو شعور من حقنا، هو مشروع، وأكيد مهما عملنا أكيد الإحساس بالحنين هيكون موجود، لأنه هي دي طبيعة التجربة، تجربة اللي بيهاجر وبيسيب أرضه وبيسيب وطنه وذكرياته ومرحلة كبيرة من حياته فاتها وسابها وجاي يبتدي من جديد. لكن لازم يكون في آليات، طرق معينة تساعدنا شوية إن إحنا ما نفضلش في الحالة دي كتير. الاستسلام لحالة الحنين هو ده الظاهرة نفسية مش هتكون كويسة على اللونج تيرم، يعني بعد فترة من دلوقتي، فترة طويلة لو بشكل مستمر، لا مش هيكون حاجة كويسة. طب إيه اللي ممكن نعمله؟ بمنتهى البساطة نحاول بقدر الإمكان إن إحنا نحتضن الوطن الجديد، نحتضن الحضارة الجديدة، التاريخ الجديد، الثقافة، نزور الأماكن التاريخية هنا، نفهم أكتر البلد، نتعرف على ناس جديدة، نجرب أكلات عمرنا ما جربناها قبل كده، نسمع أنواع من الموسيقى جديدة غير مألوفة بالنسبة لنا، ونحاول بقدر الإمكان نقطع على نفسنا خط الرجعة. يعني ما نقعدش نسترسل في الماضي ونعيش في الماضي، ده أنا كنت بشتغل كذا، ده أنا كنت بعمل كذا، ده كان عندي شقتي فين في بلدي. نحاول نتجنب استخدام السوشيال ميديا إذا كان ده هيخلينا على طول متواصلين ومشغولين باللي بيحصل هناك. وأخيراً أقول لكم، حاولوا تفتكروا دايماً إن الناس اللي أنت بتفكر فيها ممكن تكون هي خلاص بدأت إن هي تتعود على غيابك، ويعني زي ما عبد الوهاب بيقول يمكن تكون بتفكر في اللي نسيك. فياريت إن إحنا فعلاً
It makes these cuts and they only fit together one way.
Hello, listeners. This is Gambletron and Johnny Forever. Join us here on CKUT Friday, June 18th from 3 to 5 p.m. for a live broadcast of our performance, Thin Walls, Bad Internet, presented by Undefined Radio and Suoni Peril Popola.
Right,
and so utilize your flesh body to come watch us on June 18th to the 21st live at 6835 Plaza St. Hubert as we build a pirate radio station and resonant sound sculpture from construction site detritus over Zoom. To find out more, visit undefinedradio.fm.
But there's nothing on.
Okay. Can you hear us again? Can you hear us again?
We have to go.
Can you hear us?
Testing.
Can you hear us?
It's not two separate cuts, it's one cut, right?
But it's not two separate cuts. It's not two separate cuts.